Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces.
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? Will the real Weird Sisters please stand up? We're gonna have a problem here.
We're the Weird Sisters, we're the real Weird Sisters. All you other Weird Sisters are fine, but not the Vickers. Will the real Weird Sisters please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up.
Hey everyone, welcome to another book club episode of The Real Weird Sisters. I'm Alice.
And I'm Martha.
And today we're here to discuss Chapter 17 of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So, Martha, we're at the very end of Sorcerer's Stone. How are you feeling?
I know, it's crazy. I mean, I feel like we started this podcast just like really, really recently, and it's been over 2 months, or how long has it been? It's been like 3 months.
It's been 17 weeks.
17 weeks, yes. So, really fast math. That's almost 4 months, right?
Yeah. Actually, can't do math at all. So
16 weeks. Yeah, it's yeah, basically...
So maybe 3.5 months.
Yeah, I mean, almost 4 months.
Maybe we should have calculated this out ahead of time.
I think it's been about 4 months. I think our first episode was like April 12th or something, because remember the preview show too. I mean, I guess that doesn't totally count, but yeah, it's gone by really fast for me. I hopefully it's gone by fast for our listeners as well.
Yeah, thank you to everyone who's been with us since the beginning, and then also thank you to those of you who have recently joined us and maybe binge listened. We're happy to have you listening, and we really appreciate that. So, yeah, just wanted to thank you before we get started with talking about this final chapter.
Yeah, if there's anybody joining us right now, stop. Go back to the beginning.
Just kidding. Actually, earlier today I was thinking about how, like, you know, you could kind of just jump in at any point if you've read the books. You know, you don't actually have to listen to every single episode in order.
That's true, but we probably won't like you as much if you do that.
Okay, well, anyway, do you want to get into talking about the chapter, Martha?
I do want to get into talking about the chapter, but first, I just want to say we've been talking about this Dumbledore conspiracy theory for a really long time, and after this chapter... I'm just realizing, like, we didn't come up with this at all. Like, Harry comes up with it himself, and it's true. I totally buy the theory now. I'm a Dumbledore conspiracy theory truther.
Oh, yeah? You're fully on board now?
I am.
See, I kind of always was, mm-hmm. But I think, like, the question for me is, like, how far does it go?
Yeah, that's totally. I mean, I guess I have always been on board as well. You're right. But, I mean, after this chapter especially... For some reason, I'd kind of convinced myself that we came up with this theory, and I'd totally forgotten that Ron and Harry talk about it themselves, which we'll obviously get to, but I don't know, maybe I'm just, like, narcissistic or something. I was, thought we were a little bit smarter than we are, but yeah, yeah. I think it's a pretty real theory, and, you know, I don't even think it's a theory. I think it's how it happened.
Yeah, okay, so I really want to get into talking about the chapter as well, but I do have one more question from a listener that I want to address before we get going. Our listener, Shut Up Tim, who everyone's familiar with by this point, he wrote to us and he said he had a question about Chapter 16, and he was wondering why weren't the other teachers represented with the rooms? Like, for example, why didn't Professor Binns or the Muggle Studies teacher or Trelawney have a room? Martha, have you ever thought about that?
Well, we talked about it. Maybe Tim wasn't listening. We definitely talked about how if we'd had Charity Burbage doing a little bit of guarding,
oh, yeah, that's right.
Then it would have worked a little bit better, because having some sort of Muggle security system probably would have fooled a Death Eater.
But did we actually talk about that in Chapter 16, or was that earlier on?
I'm that was earlier to on.
Right. Yeah. So, Tim, I think you have a little bit of podcast amnesia. So maybe that's why you're not able to remember further back than one episode.
But, I mean, as to the other teachers, like, what's Trelawney gonna do, like, stand in a room throwing crystal balls at the people who try to get in there? And what is Binns gonna do? Bore them to death?
That would probably be a pretty good one, actually.
In the conference of 1730 BC.
Yeah, Professor Binns, I don't know.
Like, Voldemort's just, like, on the floor snoring because of how boring Professor Binns is.
Here's the thing. They could have each done something. It doesn't necessarily have to be related to what they teach.
Well, I mean, Do you think he can do anything else? He's a ghost. Like, I mean,
yeah. Okay, I think we've answered the question. I at first, when I was thinking about it, I was thinking like maybe it's just the people who Dumbledore kind of considers in his inner circle, but then I realized
it's the subjects that matter.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, not that those subjects don't matter for other things, but I mean, yeah, I think it makes sense. I suppose maybe something like arithmancy, would that help in some way? I still don't really understand what arithmancy is, so.
I have no idea either.
Yeah.
It's just like some sort of wizarding math is my understanding.
I thought it was something with logic, so I guess that's sort of like Snape's thing. But Snape created the potions, so yeah, I don't know. Ancient runes, astronomy, you know, those aren't going to help.
Yeah. Plus, you want it to be simple enough for the first years to be able to decode.
Right.
So they can't have, like, ancient runes because Hermione's never taken that class yet.
But also, I mean, like, not that Dumbledore doesn't trust his employees, but the more teachers that know about it, the, like, more likely it is that that rumor's going to get out. And I feel like if every teacher at Hogwarts knows, then that's more suspicious for Dumbledore. So, I mean, of course, we don't know how much he wanted Harry to find out, but... You know, Harry doesn't have any of those teachers either, so that's another point.
It's kind of weird that Hagrid does one of them and not, like, the current Care of Magical Creatures professor.
Right, yeah, what's his name?
I forget.
Kettleburn? Yeah,
yeah, who left later to spend more time with his remaining limbs.
Yes. Yeah, he's probably too busy, you know, taking care of those limbs here, so...
All right. Well, I think we've discussed that sufficiently. So let's go ahead and start talking about Chapter 17. What were your initial thoughts on the chapter, Martha?
Well, I remember very clearly reading this chapter back when I read it probably the first time, at least one of the very first times that I did read it. And it's just such a dramatic reveal, finding out that it's Quirrell behind the door and not Snape, and that it's Quirrell, this, you know, poor stuttering Professor Quirrell who has been trying to steal the stone and kill Harry throughout this whole book. So it's, I think it's just, it really speaks to J.K. Rowling's ability as, you know, a mystery writer to be able to have that reveal be so dramatic in the very beginning of this chapter. But as I was reading it this time, I was kind of surprised by how short the time with Voldemort actually is. It goes by really fast, and almost immediately we're in the hospital wing, and Dumbledore's explaining everything. I had kind of forgotten that this was the last chapter, and I kind of thought that the scene with Voldemort was one chapter, and then the scene with Dumbledore and winning the House Cup and everything, I kind of thought that that was the final chapter. I mean, which it is, but I thought it was its own separate chapter.
Yeah, I agree. I was kind of surprised at how short the time he spent with Voldemort was. You know, honestly, it kind of makes sense because really, how long could Harry hold Voldemort off?
True. And also, I feel like because it's the first book, which is so catered to younger children, you don't want it to be the moments of, you know, peril. You don't want that to be too terrifying or to last too long.
Right. But back to your earlier point, I wanted to say that when I first read this, I also was just extremely shocked that it was Quirrell. And I agree. I mean, it really speaks to how this book is really a successful mystery in addition to, you know, a fantasy book.
Yeah.
Because we really have Harry thinking, there's the red herring of Snape the whole time, who Harry thinks is the bad guy. And then we have this reveal that I really don't think that anyone would see coming. But at the same time, it makes perfect sense. And there are those clues dropped throughout you know, make it work out in the end.
Yeah, I agree. And she's just, I mean, obviously we think she's an amazing writer. And I still haven't got, I feel horrible confessing this. I still haven't read the Robert Galbraith series. So I need to do that, obviously. I can tell just from reading this, of course, that she is a very skillful mystery writer. And yeah, I mean, you've read those, so you can probably speak to that more.
Yeah, I really enjoy the mystery series. I've read all three of them, and I really think that you would like them too. I know how it is with trying to get to things now that you're an adult. That's why I haven't read Harry Potter as much in recent years. But Definitely worth your time. And any listeners who haven't read them, I definitely recommend them. The first book was my least favorite, and then since then they've gotten progressively better. So I think once Martha does get the time to read them, we will do some special coverage of those books.
Right.
But I agree. She's a very good mystery writer.
It's funny that you say that you haven't had time to read Harry Potter in recent years because you're an adult. I mean, I haven't had time to read books like The Cuckoo's Calling because I've been reading Harry Potter so much as an adult, trying to catch up to you.
Yeah. Well, that too. I mean, yeah. You know, you have to sacrifice one thing or the other.
Right.
So anyway, when you think back on the first time you read it, how long did it take you to really accept that it was Quirrell in that moment?
I'm trying to remember. Oh, I think like the first time I read it, like I said, I was really surprised. And it's not until Quirrell starts explaining everything, all the things that Harry had used Snape as an explanation for, when it starts to really click that, yes, Quirrell is the bad guy of this book. And then, it, of course, once he takes the turban off, that's the real clincher.
Yeah, for sure. So he does start in and he's going through and he's – every time that – I think Harry's kind of working as like a plot device to kind of act like the reader in this moment. He goes, but Snape tried to kill me. And then Quirrell will refute him and say, no, I tried to kill you. And then he explains exactly how he tried to kill him and why.
Yeah.
And then Harry says, so Harry just keeps arguing with him, like, well, this doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And then that gives Quirrell a chance to explain to Harry and to the reader, you know, exactly how it works out that he was the bad guy.
Right. And I really like the explanation J.K. Rowling gives for why Harry is asking all these questions. Harry instinctually thinks that he needs to just keep Quirrell talking so that Quirrell won't be able to figure out how to get the stone. So that's a really good, first of all, it's quick thinking on Harry's part. And then also it's just, it makes sense that the reader, we as the reader need to know why Quirrell is there and what his role in the story is. And Harry does serve as a good plot device in that way.
Yeah, that's really true. I think, you know, this shows how Harry really is good in a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you said, it's a good plot device. The other thing I really like is how we see like a really almost a physical change in Quirrell to kind of show how maybe that was just an act, how he was stuttering and, you know, looking all nervous all the time. Do you think that Quirrell really was just acting the whole time, or do you think that maybe he really was nervous but about different things than what we were thinking?
Well, I mean, I kind of had forgotten that the stutter completely disappears. And as I was reading it this time, I was like, this is, yeah, I mean, it seems a little bit too convenient that he suddenly lost the stutter because I can't believe that Quirrell could be that good of an actor.
Yeah, for the entire year. And then
right.
The other thing is like, so Quirrell used to be a teacher at Hogwarts.
Allegedly.
Allegedly was a teacher.
Not allegedly Muggle studies.
And before, so, and he took a leave of absence the year before Harry got there. And that's when Voldemort met him in the forest and overtook him, right?
Right.
So before that, he wasn't a bad guy, or was
he? Right, because he had ideas of good and evil, right? He had these foolish ideas, idealistic ideas of good and evil, and then Voldemort convinced him, which I don't really understand still whether it was under the Imperius. Well, he wasn't able to do the Imperius Curse. I guess he was possessing Quirrell. Did he first convince Quirrell and then possess him, or did he just possess Quirrell?
I kind of see it as kind of similar to the way that Tom Riddle possessed Ginny in the second book.
Uh-huh.
Like, where there he wasn't a physical body either.
Right. On Pottermore, there's this article about it's a character profile of Professor Quirrell, and J.K. Rowling says that he had this latent desire. It says a latent desire to make the world sit up and notice him. So he set out deliberately to find Voldemort, and so that's what he was doing on his quest. His year off, he was looking for Voldemort to track him down, and apparently only to be the one to find him, not necessarily to follow him. I'm kind of confused about this article in some ways, but I guess Quirrell went out looking for Voldemort, so that's how he found him.
Okay, so he somehow found him, and I see it kind of like the type of possession like how Ginny was possessed. And
right.
Like, it makes sense because Ginny was a child, so
yeah.
She was easily manipulated. and here, same thing. Quirrell seems like he was already sort of open to this idea of, you know, he didn't really know what he believed, or he had delusions of grandeur maybe, and was pretty open to being sort of brainwashed by this soul.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting that you compare it to Ginny Weasley, because in this article, J.K. Rowling says that Quirrell is turned into a temporary Horcrux by Voldemort, basically, because he's possessed and he's basically controlled by Voldemort. He has that part of Voldemort in him, so his soul is controlled by Voldemort. So that's So that's why when Harry touches him, he can't stand it.
Okay, that's really interesting, because So Voldemort had a piece of his soul that was just out in the open.
Right.
Right. So that must be the one that overtook Quirrell.
Right.
And then it kind of latched on to Quirrell. So it's interesting, because it sounds like his piece of his soul took off from Quirrell's body at just the right moment, or actually that would have been a Horcrux that would have been destroyed.
Right. That's exactly right. It says that when the body Voldemort and Quirrell are sharing is horribly burned by contact with Harry, the former, meaning Voldemort, flees just in time to save himself.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves here. because Quirrell is still alive at the beginning of the chapter.
Right.
Going back to what he was saying, I thought it was really funny when he talks about the troll, and I like how he says he has a special gift with trolls.
Which, I mean, first thing, Dumbledore knows that this is the protection that Quirrell's doing for the stone, right? So how does he not suspect Quirrell when the troll's getting let in on Halloween? Did we talk about this?
I don't remember if we talked about it. I don't think we did, and I think that it's a pretty fair question. Like, okay, either A, suspect him, or B, wonder why Quirrell isn't the one to, like, be able to track down the troll and get rid of it.
Yeah, that too.
But, like, the fact that Quirrell runs in and is terrified of the troll.
Yeah.
But then he's the one who sets up the troll as the
troll
obstacle.
Troll! In the dungeon! Thought you ought to know.
I don't know. It is a little bit fishy in that sense. But again, this kind of speaks to the Dumbledore conspiracy theory that maybe Dumbledore knew the whole time that Quirrell was being possessed.
DCT.
Yes, we know how you love acronyms, Martha.
Well, the thing is that Dumbledore conspiracy theory is a bit of a tongue twister, similar to the title of our show. So that's why we say RWS, and that's why we say DCT.
All right, well, I like the moment here where Harry discovers that the mirror is in the room. It's kind of funny because he's looking at Quirrell so much that he doesn't even notice that the mirror is in the room until you know, a little bit later when Quirrell goes over and is trying to go examine the mirror.
Right, and I can relate to that. I mean, when you're in a scary situation, you tend to focus only on the scary thing in front of you or the shocking thing in front of you. Harry's probably scared of Quirrell at this point, but his initial reaction is shock. You know, he can't believe that it's Quirrell who's there. So of course he doesn't notice the rest of the room. This harmless mirror in the corner has nothing to do with the emotion he's feeling. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and Quirrell obviously knows that the mirror is the key to finding the stone, but he doesn't know how it works because Dumbledore didn't tell that to anyone.
Right.
But. Yeah, I like how he says, trust Dumbledore to come up with something like this, but he's in London, because he just to call us back to the fact that Dumbledore is in London.
Right.
So then this is where we get to the point where J.K. Rowling throws in that line that you were telling us about, how it says all Harry could do was think to keep Quirrell talking about the mirror and distracted.
Right.
So he brings up Snape, and I was really interested this time around to see that that Harry says to Quirrell, but Snape seemed to hate me so much. And Quirrell just responds like, oh yes, he does.
Heavens, yes.
So it's like, has Snape been kind of complaining about Harry behind his back to
I feel like it's honestly kind of common knowledge for everybody in the wizarding world besides Harry that that Snape and James Potter were rivals at Hogwarts. I mean, I feel like everybody knows that besides Harry.
So Quirrell explains that to Harry. This is the first time that Harry's actually heard that.
Right. Well, does Hagrid not mention it to him at all?
Well, I was thinking about it because as I read it, I'm like, is this the first time Harry's actually heard this? And then later on in the chapter, that's one of the things that Harry asks Dumbledore. He says, Quirrell said that Snape hated my dad and that's why he hates me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he must makes not it have... sound like that's the first time he's heard that.
Oh, you're right. Because when Harry brings it up to when Harry brings it up to Hagrid, Hagrid has a shifty look on his face and he's like, oh, why would he hate you?
Yeah, he's really shady about it.
Right.
Anyway, I think it's kind of weird though, because like, I get what you're saying about how it's kind of common knowledge, but like, why does Quirrell know that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of part of the lore of Hogwarts for people who are there, I guess. That's just always
maybe
how
Quirrell
I
was
felt.
Maybe Quirrell was the Muggle Studies professor way back when.
Maybe. Isn't he supposed to be pretty young here? I mean, I guess actually Lily and James are pretty. I mean, really
old. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how old Quirrell was supposed to be, so maybe that probably doesn't work out, but it could.
Yeah.
So Harry keeps Quirrell talking, and he says, I heard you a few days ago sobbing. And this is when Quirrell first starts showing signs that he might be possessed.
Right.
He says, sometimes I find it hard to follow my master's instructions. He's a great wizard and I am weak. And then Harry's like, wait, he was in the classroom with you?
Yeah.
And then this is where we get, like I said, the first real hint of the possession, because Quirrell says, he's with me wherever I go.
Yeah, that's a really chilling line. Especially just because we've had this big reveal that it's Quirrell, and then there's another big reveal that, yes, Quirrell has been working with Voldemort. And another really chilling line that comes right after is pretty iconic line is Quirrell is talking about how he became possessed by Voldemort. Basically, he doesn't use the word possessed or anything, but he's talking about when he was traveling and Voldemort found him and says he learned that there is no good and evil. There is only power and those too weak to seek it. Of course, Harry Potter series is going to have the play with the ideas of good and evil throughout. And this is kind of the first time we get somebody's opinion on what the definition of good and evil is or whether it exists and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think that's a really strong line, but I have to admit, I don't really understand it. Do you?
I think I do.
There's only power and those too weak to seek it.
So,
okay,
I mean,
because when I read it, when I read it the right way, I hear it correctly.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, it's saying there's only power, and then there are people who are too weak to seek power.
Yeah, exactly.
But to me, whenever I read it, for some reason, it always reads to me, there is only power, and those too weak to seek it, meaning like, the people who seek power are weak.
Hmm.
Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can hear that now. Yeah, because it's like the people who are seeking it are the ones who are too weak. Yeah, I can see that. I've never thought of it that way. That's interesting.
And it always confused me because I'm like, wait, so he doesn't think it's good to seek power? Because you know that he does think it's good to seek
power. That's so interesting that you've read it that way because
I've reread it in my head correctly, but then I always kind of forget because I always naturally read it the wrong way for some reason.
So sort of like, you see it sort of like there's only power and those who are so weak that they seek power.
Yes, exactly.
Huh. I mean, that would be confusing.
But do you see how it does read both ways?
It does read both ways. It's kind of a confusing sentence in that way. But
it's just me being dumb. I mean, the thing is, like, all along, I've always known that that's not his opinion. Like, I've known that he thinks it's good to seek power.
Right.
But it just always confused me when I would read it.
Yeah.
So, that's anyway. It's interesting that I would be interested to hear if other people had ever read it that way as well, or if it's just me.
It might just be you. I don't know.
So here we get Harry starting to think about how to get the stone, and he's put it together that the stone is going to be in the mirror, and that if he looks in the mirror, it's going to teach him how to find it.
Right.
But he doesn't want Quirrell to see him looking in the mirror and then also be sort of you know, alerted as to where the stone is.
Right. So he's kind of trying to, like, inch his way over to the mirror, but he's tied together, basically, so he can't go anywhere.
Yeah, and he trips and falls over.
It's really embarrassing.
This is another one of those moments that we talked about a little bit in last chapter where it's like, yeah, Harry does know a lot, but, and he is really precocious for an 11-year-old as far as, knowing what to do in a crisis, yeah. But then he also has these moments where it's like, okay, he really is just an 11-year-old. Right.
Trips and falls over. Yeah, that's pretty embarrassing, Harry.
Right. And then, so Quirrell's standing in front of the mirror, and he's looking in the mirror, and then he's really confused. He's talking out loud, and then it says, to Harry's horror, a voice answered, and it says, use the boy.
Mm-hmm.
Really creepy line.
It's really creepy.
When you read it, I don't really remember how I reacted. Do you remember if you had any idea what was happening? Were you just confused?
Maybe I'm just overestimating myself now that I'm looking back, but I'm pretty sure I always knew it was Voldemort at that point, because he's just said, my master's with me wherever I go. I don't think I immediately knew that he was coming from Quirrell's head, but I always did think that was Voldemort, just somewhere in the room.
Yeah. So anyway, then Quirrell decides to bring Harry in front of the mirror and have him look in it, and Harry's thinking, okay, all I have to do is lie, and I like the lie that Harry comes up with.
Right.
He says, I see myself shaking hands with Dumbledore. I've won the house cup for Gryffindor.
Yeah, which is gonna happen at the end of this chapter, basically. But one thing that's interesting is that's basically what Ron sees when he looks in the mirror the first time, and it really, it's kind of sad that Harry uses Ron's example because it's such a shallow thing. It's like such a shallow, unimportant thing. I think if Ron had been looking at the mirror at this point in the story, he probably would have seen himself getting the stone, and he probably would have been able to do the same thing Harry does. But it's kind of depressing that Harry uses Ron's deepest desire as a fake desire, which he knows is going to be believable, but, well, he thinks it's going to be believable, but at the same time, he knows it's really shallow.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, like, it's honestly kind of a good thing that Harry had that lie, you know, that he had that in his head, because otherwise it would have been probably pretty tough to just come up with something on the spot like that.
Yeah, probably.
But it is realistic, because it seems like something that an 11-year-old would care about.
Yeah. But Voldemort immediately knows that it's false. I guess he's in a very weakened state, but he's able to do legitimacy. What do you think?
Yeah.
Or is Harry a bad liar?
Well, I don't think Harry's a bad liar, because Quirrell falls for it.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, Voldemort's the one who then, can see through it. And I agree. I think he must be doing legitimacy, because, you know, he can't really see Harry at this moment. He's all wrapped up in a turban.
Right. Oh, don't you need to... Do you need to make eye contact to do legitimacy? No.
Well, I think it helps.
Yeah.
Maybe he can look through Quirrell's eyes? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, but...
But anyway, we didn't really talk about the fact that Harry got the stone.
Oh, yeah. Harry's standing in front of the mirror, and he gets the stone. It falls into his pocket.
Yeah. It's just, it's so easy the way it happens that it's like, you almost forget about it.
Right. And in the movie, they do a good job of it. It really, Harry's standing in front of the mirror. He's wearing that cute little red sweater. And...
That's what we care about.
I love that red sweater.
And matches the stone.
Yeah, and he's wearing some corduroy pants, I think. And he's standing in front of the mirror, and then he kind of feels this heavy thing fall into his pocket, and he sticks his hand in his pocket, and he realizes the stone is there.
Yeah. Although he doesn't actually stick his hand into his pocket.
Right.
In the book, because that would be kind of obvious.
Yeah.
But true. He just feels the stone fall into his pocket. The thing is, we wouldn't be able to see that in the movie, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
After Voldemort has kind of uncovered the fact that Harry is lying, he says that he would like to speak to Harry again. And again, it says the high voice. And we talked about this a little bit. Like, does he have, like, a really high, squeaky, like, Professor Flitwick-like voice? Or what exactly does that mean to you?
I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I always just associate cold with the voice. And until mm-hmm. we'd had this discussion, I kind of just equated cold with high, but it's,
yeah, me
it's
too,
not the same.
I mean, yeah, I've never heard that used that
way.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird because it's like, it just...
He lies. I want to speak to him myself.
I always heard it in my head as a very chilling voice, like right. you said, a cold voice. But high, I don't know. It's a weird adjective.
It is.
But so anyway, after he says, let me speak to him face to face, this is where one of the scariest moments, I think.
Totally.
Because it says Harry felt as if Devil's Snare was rooting him to the spot. It's like, first of all, it's good that we recently saw what that is so that we can have that little, that
analogy,
little
yeah.
simile in there.
Yeah.
And then he's just kind of rooted to the spot, like we said, and he's watching Quirrell begin to unwrap his turban. And it's a moment of real confusion and also just, like, it's creepy. It's really creepy.
Yeah, totally. And then when he, yeah, especially when he does unwrap the turban and the face starts speaking. It says it's the most horrible face Harry's ever seen.
Yeah, chalk white with glaring red eyes and slits for nostrils like a snake.
Right. Let's just talk about the slits for nostrils right now, because, of course, the big thing that people always like to make fun of Voldemort for is having no nose. And let the record state that the book never says Voldemort has no nose. It never says he has slits for a nose. It says he has slits for nostrils, which...
That's true. That's very, very true.
There's a big difference between nostrils and a nose. You know, you can have a nose with very... very teeny nostrils and still have a defined nose. You don't have to just have two lines where your nose should be. So I mean, I don't really have a problem with the way that Voldemort looks in the movies. I think he's pretty good, but I mean, the whole no nose thing, it definitely was created by the movie producers.
Yeah, and the only thing that kind of speaks towards the no nose thing is the fact that it says like a snake.
Yeah.
Cause then those are kind of like, I mean, okay, and there are some snakes that kind of have, like, a little pig snout type thing, but most snakes, they are just, the nostrils are flat on the body of the snake, or the head of the snake, you know? So maybe...
I don't think so. I think it would say slits for a nose if it was like that. It's slits for nostrils.
True. I bet J.K. Rowling kind of like regrets the moment she wrote that and wishes she would have made it a little bit more clear.
Yeah.
A prominent nose with slits for nostrils. Yes,
exactly.
That would have been a little bit more effective to get the character to look right.
Yeah. And of course, this moment is even more terrifying once that face starts speaking and it just says, Harry Potter, and it whispers it. It says it whispers. It doesn't say he whispered. It's the face that's speaking. It's not Voldemort that's speaking.
Well, and that's a really interesting distinction, because like we've said, this isn't an actual human right now.
Right.
This is a piece of a soul, obviously a very tormented soul that's, you know, done great evil.
Yeah, mere shadow and vapor is what it says here.
Yeah, and it says he has form only when he can share another's body.
Right.
And then he says, but there have always been those willing to let me into their hearts and minds. Unicorn blood has strengthened me these past weeks. You saw faithful Quirrell drinking it for me in the forest. And that's where I wanted to point that out, because last week we talked about Tim's theory that Quirrell was flipping over and allowing Voldemort to drink it himself. But from the sound of this, Quirrell was the one drinking the blood.
Right.
So... he could probably just do that on his regular hands and knees instead of crab walk style.
Yeah. In this conversation, it's especially, the real clincher is when he says, why don't you give me that stone in your pocket? And Harry's just realized immediately that Voldemort knows. He doesn't just know that Harry was lying. He knows exactly what Harry was lying about. And it's kind of
right.
like... there's no way out at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that really does speak to the idea that he was using legitimacy. Because,
okay,
maybe not when he found – when he heard that he was lying. But I think at this point, he definitely is facing Harry now. So he was able to then look in Harry's mind and see exactly where the stone was.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right.
Yeah. So then Voldemort starts describing Harry's parents' murders, he says, better save your own life or join me, or you'll meet the same end as your parents. They died begging for mercy. And, you know, this is where we see this streak of pride in Harry.
Right. He immediately says liar. He shouts it, and he's very brave. He's almost recklessly brave at this point because, I mean, you don't want to temper the beast here.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, don't poke the bear. Just kind of maybe accept what the bear is saying. But...
Snake.
I mean, yeah, that's true. I don't think that that's, you know, something that Harry can do. He has to stand up for what he believes in.
Right. And I like how the Voldemort is like, oh, how touching.
I know. He's always so, like, sarcastic.
Yeah, he's really snarky.
He does say he values bravery. That's interesting because if he values bravery, it just shows really maybe how ambitious and cunning he was that he wasn't placed in Gryffindor.
Right. Well, what kind of bravery does he value? He values bravery when it betters him. He really values cowardice because almost all of his Death Eaters are really cowardly, and that's why they are following him.
That's true. It's like something that a politician would say.
Right.
But it would mean something completely different.
Exactly. I mean, characters like Bellatrix, I guess they're brave because they'll do anything to save Voldemort or to help Voldemort. But most of the Death Eaters are mostly cowardly. So, I mean, it's definitely saying he values bravery. I mean, I don't know. Doesn't he say something like this to Neville in the final scene with when Neville kills Nagini?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of like his propaganda to try to get people to turn to his side. But here we, like I said, we get him describing the murders. And he describes it accurately where he says he killed Harry's father first. But Harry's mother didn't need to die because she was trying to protect Harry. And this is actually the first time that Harry's ever heard their death scene actually described to him in that kind of a detail.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, that Voldemort is so honest about it. It kind of reminds me of the scenes in, you know, spy movies where the supervillain is revealing the whole plot before they think they're about to win, but then of course they lose. But Voldemort, definitely the only reason he's telling Harry so much information at this point is because he thinks he's about to kill Harry, right?
I think so. I mean, it doesn't really have anything to lose by telling Harry that. It's not like he can, like, go to prison or something, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's giving Harry information. And, of course, I mean, it's information that, you know, Dumbledore probably already had. But, I mean, the fact that Voldemort, who was the only real witness to this crime, is the one who's telling Harry now. Dumbledore might have had theories as to why Harry could survive, but Dumbledore couldn't have known for sure that... Lily sacrificed herself for Harry, and that's why he survived. Like, that probably was Dumbledore's theory, knowing how smart Dumbledore is and how much Dumbledore values love. But because Voldemort reveals this to Harry here, Dumbledore now knows for sure.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And you're right. I mean, it does actually end up harming Voldemort that he tells Harry this, because then Dumbledore knows exactly what the protection was that Harry had.
Exactly.
So anyway, after they have this little conversation, Harry tries to jump towards the door. I mean, I don't know how much good that would have done him because it's a door of fire, so he can't really get out anyway.
Right.
And then Voldemort, screams, seize him!
Seize him!
It's kind of weird that he has to shout it because, you know, I thought he could communicate with Quirrell more silently, but...
I like how it says he shrieked it.
Oh, in my book it says he screamed. Oh, well, wait, no, yeah, later on shrieked. Right. Yeah, you're right. Because he says seize him three times, actually.
Yeah. And then he starts screaming, kill him. But, of course, Harry instinctually just kind of, like, tries to push Quirrell off, and immediately that blisters Quirrell, which, of course, Harry had no idea that was going to happen. But
right. And then, I mean... It's not like he would have necessarily put that together. Like, he might have thought that it was just, like, the fire getting close to Quirrell or something.
Yeah.
But then Quirrell says, like, I can't hold him, my hands.
Yeah.
And then so then it's clear that it's, like, it's Harry who is causing his hands to be blistering.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, Harry, quick on his feet, like always, it says Harry, by instinct, reached up and grabbed Quirrell's face. So that's
good. Yeah. And it was right before Quirrell was about to perform a deadly curse.
Right.
So that was kind of scary.
Yeah. Seriously. Good thing Harry's instincts kicked in right away.
Yeah. Maybe Quirrell should have stood back at a distance to try and shoot the curse. He doesn't have to be right up next to him for that.
Right. Good point. But yeah, it's pretty convenient that Quirrell's right there and Harry's able to grab his face. And it says his only chance was to keep hold of Quirrell, keep him in enough pain to stop him from doing a curse. So that's when he, like, really grabs Quirrell and hangs on as tight as he can.
Yeah. And then basically the scene ends because Harry kind of passes out. And, right. So the next thing we know, Harry's in the hospital wing.
Right. I like how it says Harry hears, all he can hear is Quirrell's terrible shrieks and Voldemort's yells of kill him, kill him. And other voices, maybe in Harry's own head, crying, Harry, Harry. So
you know, what made me think that might be is it might be Lily or James shouting that.
Yeah.
You know, like when Harry hears the Dementors and he hears
his
parents.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Because the fact that it says maybe in Harry's own head, of course, it's probably Dumbledore trying to bring him back to life, I guess. I mean, not that he's about to die, but he's in a critical condition. But I think you're right. His scar is hurting, so it's very possible that he's reliving the night that his parents died.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, it says voices, so maybe he hears Dumbledore in the real world, and then he hears his parents in his head.
Yeah.
But he wakes up and he's in the hospital wing. He thinks he sees the snitch. He's all disoriented.
It's a really goofy scene.
It's like, he sees the snitch, but it's actually a pair of glasses, and it's Dumbledore. Why is Dumbledore, like, leaning over Harry's face like this?
Yeah. You can't see it, obviously, because it's not a video, but he's, like, leaning down, leering at Harry. I really like the way it's written. It says, something gold was glinting just above him. The snitch! But he's like, oh, it's not the snitch, it's Dumbledore's glasses.
Yeah. But as soon as Harry comes to, he's, again, immediately not thinking of himself first. He's, like, thinking of the stone. As soon as he wakes up, he's shouting out, the stone, Quirrell, he has it and stuff. So, you know, it shows Harry's true nature.
Totally. He's very selfless.
And I like how even Professor Dumbledore is so respectful of Madame Pomfrey because he's like, Harry, relax, or Madame Pomfrey's going to have me kicked out.
Right.
Because it's like, this is your school. I don't think she can kick you out,
Dumbledore. Oh, but she would. And Dumbledore would respect it if she did, too. He would totally go if she told him to go.
Yeah, that's probably true. So Harry looks around and he sees that there's a table with lots of different candies and stuff on it, and I love the quote from Dumbledore. He says, what happened down in the dungeons between you and Professor Quirrell is a complete secret. So naturally the whole school knows.
Yeah, I like that too.
And we find out that Harry has been passed out for 3 days.
Yeah, which is a long time.
Really extreme. I mean, in any of the other books, he's never out for that long, is he?
I don't think so.
It's almost like he was, like, petrified by a basilisk or something. Yeah. Like, for how long he's just, like, unconscious.
Right. And it says, like, they were almost worried that he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah, which makes sense because, you know, he was, like, down in the heat of that fiery room. And then, you know, his scar was, like, about to split open.
Right. And he's done way more magic than he's able, like, not spell magic, but, you know, the magic of holding Quirrell's face, and that takes a lot out of him.
Yeah, exactly. So we get confirmation here from what we were talking about last week that Dumbledore did not come back when he got Hermione's owl. He says he must have crossed mid-air with the owl because he was already on his way back. He says, no sooner had I reached London than it became clear to me that the place I should be was the one I had just left.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of sounds like he was flying because he says in midair.
I know. I think that too. And you know what? I think it's possible that apparition might not be something that J.K. Rowling was originally thinking was going to be part of her world because it is nowhere to be seen in this book.
No, we talked about this before. It's in the first chapter when Dumbledore arrives on the street.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
I was thinking that too. No, I honestly, the only reason I had that so fresh on my tongue like that was because I had had this exact same thought in my head. Like, well, we haven't seen anybody else apparate, so maybe she hadn't thought of it, but he totally apparated in the first chapter.
Yeah, you're totally right. But was he flying on a broom? That seems like a very weird image. Was he on a thestral?
Maybe, but like, why?
We know he's seen death, so.
If he knows he needs to get back to Hogwarts really fast, why wouldn't he just apparate?
He's not trying to get back really fast.
That's true, exactly.
Exactly. I mean, it all adds up, people.
But boy, he pushes it to the limit, though. Like, Harry almost died.
He feared he might be too late. Well, maybe you should have apparated, buddy.
Maybe you should have gone a little bit more quickly.
Yeah, maybe you should have actually gone to London.
He was probably flying in, like, I don't even know. Just like
it sounds kind of like, I mean, it's like he was taking the night bus, like a leisurely vacay.
Yeah, seriously. It's weird. But like we said, I do think it's Dumbledore style.
Yeah, it is.
So he tells Harry that the stone has been destroyed. And again, Harry, you know, his first thought, it's not anything about himself. He's just concerned about Nicholas Flamel and, you know, your poor friend, now he's going to die, right?
Yeah.
And then, first of all, I think it's funny because Dumbledore is, he says, oh, you know about Nicholas? And he sounds quite delighted. And he said, you did do the thing properly, didn't you? And he's very proud of Harry for, you know, finding out the full story and not just cutting corners and figuring it out at the last second, right?
He's like, oh, I'm kind of surprised that Hagrid let that part slip. He didn't have to let that part slip. I was just counting on him to let the fluffy part slip.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get the great line from Dumbledore after Harry says, you know, he's concerned about Nicholas and his wife. And Harry says, Dumbledore says, to the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. And this is a line that, you know, one of the most memorable quotes of the series, I think. And it really speaks to kind of some of the underlying themes of the book as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a really powerful line, and it's something that I don't get the line yet, and I'm going to, hopefully, before I die, whenever that is, hopefully in a long time. But I'm obviously not old enough or wise enough to totally understand that line, and yet I do know that I do need to understand that line eventually. That's a goal that I think everybody should have, that before you die, that death needs to seem like the next great adventure and not something to be afraid of, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really, you know, an interesting line because it makes sense that Dumbledore says it. And it's a really powerful line, but it's like Dumbledore is not the one who came up with that. J.K. Rowling came up with that. So that shows us, again, how wise she is and what a powerful writer she is to be able to come up with a concept like that. And I mean, obviously, it's not completely original, and people have said that kind of thing before, but she has a way of phrasing it in a way that is very powerful, and it sticks in your head really well.
And, you know, I mean, it comes from, I'm 100% sure, it comes from the fact that she struggled with depression and came out of depression, and I'm sure that she struggled with that a lot while she was depressed, and this is the knowledge she came out of that with, and she, because she was able to come out of that, period of her life where she was very depressed, she now is wise enough to know this truth about life that not very many people know.
Yeah, and I mean, she has had personal loss in her own life with her mother dying at a relatively young age.
Right.
And I'm sure that was something that she tried to grapple with a lot. I mean, these books are really a testament to her own personal struggles as well.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a great line. Dumbledore, it does a really good job of delivering it. And, you know, Harry says he doesn't, you know, fully describe or fully understand it either. By the end of the series, he really does come to understand it, even though he's only 17.
Right. Well, of course he does, because he basically dies and comes back to life. So he's able to see that when he's ready to accept death, obviously he has learned this lesson. And of course, when I say it's not something everybody knows, I think it's something that everybody knows they ought to know, or people pretend to accept, but not very many people are totally there yet. And that's why it's so powerful that J.K. Rowling is writing it here, because I think she does totally accept that.
Right. And I think when Harry, I mean, like we said, by the end of the series, when he walks into the forest,
yeah,
that's when he really accepts the line.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we get another great line in a minute, because Harry says he's been thinking about, you know, even if the stone's gone, is you know who, he's trying to ask the question about whether or not Voldemort's going to try to come back in other ways. And that's when we get the other great line that gets repeated throughout the series, that Dumbledore tells Harry, you should definitely call him Voldemort.
Yeah.
Because fear of a name increases fear of the thing itself. And later on, Harry and Hermione will say this pretty frequently.
Yeah.
It's Harry's justification for always saying Voldemort. Right. When, you know, really, the reason he always says Voldemort is because he never really knew that it should be taboo.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's pretty easy for him, but...
This was my senior quote in my yearbook, which is not the quote that I submitted. Very interestingly, I submitted the quote, of course it is happening in your head, Harry, but why should that mean that it's not real? But somehow, miraculously, this is the quote that showed up in the yearbook my senior year.
That's weird.
I even went back and checked the form that I'd filled out, and it said the quote that I wanted, which was the happening in your head, Harry. And somehow this quote ended up in the yearbook, which is, of course, it's a great line, but it's not the quote I submitted. So somebody on the yearbook staff probably, maybe my whole thing didn't even get submitted. They were like, oh, Martha likes Harry Potter. Let's put this in there.
Yeah, or maybe they were like, well, we don't like the name Martha, but we're going to have to say it in here because fear of a name only increases the fear of the thing itself.
Very funny.
Just kidding. Uh-huh. No, that's hilarious that it got replaced with another Harry Potter quote.
It's so weird. I still don't get it. And I love this quote. I think it's a little bit less applicable or less important in my life. I love the mind quote because I'm a psychology major, so I just love the happening in your head quote that much. I mean, this one's good too, but I mean, it doesn't apply that much to my life the way the other one does.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, but this line, it is empowering.
Oh, totally.
I think that it is very true. And this is, again, where it's like, wow, yeah, it's obvious that Dumbledore could come up with a line like that if he was a real person. But, mm-hmm. like, the fact that J.K. Rowling came up with it, I mean, it shows what a great writer she is.
Right. And it's the quote I always use when I talk about banned books, because, like, I remember in my freshman year English class in high school, we were reading Huckleberry Finn, and, of course, we were talking about how it's No, not Huckleberry Finn, To Kill a Mockingbird. We were talking about how it's banned in a lot of places because of the language that it uses. And I was like, fear of a name only increases fear of the thing itself. So, and I was like, oh, this actually is a really applicable quote.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's good for the banned books argument and plenty of other things as well.
Totally. I mean, it's just basically if you don't talk about something, then it's just going to be even more... even worse. It's the problem needs to get talked about.
Right. So then Harry's able to ask his question about, is Voldemort going to die? Or he's going to try to come back, basically, is what he's saying.
And right. Harry immediately knows that Voldemort's not gone.
Yeah. He's like, that wasn't enough to kill him. And Dumbledore basically confirms that. It says he left Quirrell to die, and he basically confirms that he had left Quirrell's body.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe this has delayed his return to power, but not forever.
Yeah.
So then Harry asks Dumbledore if he can ask him a few questions, and Dumbledore says, here's another great quote, yeah. He says, and Harry says, I'd like to know the truth. And Dumbledore says, the truth. It is a beautiful and terrible thing, and I should therefore be treated with great caution. And he says that he will not lie, but that there might be questions that Harry will ask him that he might not be able to answer.
Yeah.
And here we get a question. I mean, this is definite definite foreshadowing.
Totally.
Or maybe not foreshadowing, but seed planting.
Yeah.
Harry says, Voldemort said that he only tried to kill my mother because she tried to stop him from killing me. But why would he want to kill me in the first place? Because he's starting to put it together. Like, why would he be out to target a little baby?
Right.
You can go ahead.
Oh, yes, but then, of course, Dumbledore can't answer it. He says, alas, the very first thing you ask me is the question I can't answer. So, I mean, like you said, it's definitely seed planting that this prophecy is something that was definitely not created in the fifth book. It's something that's led this whole plot of the entire series, that the reason that Voldemort goes after Harry in the first place, he's not going after James and Lily, he's going after Harry because he's heard that this baby is the chosen one. So I think that that's, it is seed planting, but I think it's also foreshadowing. I think J.K. Rowling had the idea for the prophecy in mind from the very beginning.
Oh yeah, that was definitely something that she had planned from the beginning, that there was a reason that Voldemort was out to target Harry.
Right.
So then the next question that Harry asks is, why couldn't Quirrell touch him? And this is when Dumbledore confirms that the reason was because Lily had died to save Harry. And it's interesting because this is one of those forms of magic that Voldemort really seems to discredit or doesn't know about.
Right, and it's really interesting. I mean, I just love the theme of love throughout the series, how important love is, and how powerful it is. It's the most powerful magic in this universe that she's created, and I think that that's amazing. I also just really love this scene where Dumbledore is explaining it to Harry. It doesn't outright say that Harry's crying, but it says as Dumbledore is giving this very powerful, very emotional explanation, he says, it was agony for Quirrell to touch a person marked by something so good, and that something so good is love. And it says, Dumbledore now became very interested in a bird out on the windowsill, which gave Harry time to dry his eyes on the sheet. That's just really sweet. I really like that it doesn't say, like, Harry discovered that there were tears in his eyes. Like, I love that Dumbledore now became interested in a bird on the windowsill, because you could kind of skate over it a little bit. But of course, that's a really, really powerful revelation that Harry's mother, who he's lived without for the last 10 years of his life, this is confirmation that, yes, his mother loved him more than anything in the world. She died to save him, and that's why Harry can survive. And that's just such an empowering and really, really awesome thing.
It says, to have been loved so deeply, even though the person who loved us is gone, will give us some protection forever. It is in your very skin.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's really a powerful moment. And, I mean, again, the first book, a lot of times, I think, you know, it gets a little bit of criticism because it's more of a children's book in the style, and it's kind of lighter content, but it has some really powerful moments in it. I mean, with the Mirror of Erised and with this, we really get to see a lot about the themes that go through the entire series.
Right, and one of those themes is that the people we love never truly leave us, and the people that love us never truly leave us. And very literally, Lily's love is never going to leave Harry because he's protected by it, literally protected by it. And that's just, I love the way that that is embodied in the series. It's not just a, you know, metaphorical kind of protection. It's totally literal.
Yeah, exactly. So the next question that Harry asks is, do you know who gave me the invisibility cloak? And then this is when Dumbledore basically confirms that, you know, he had given it to Harry, that James had given it to Dumbledore before he died. So that was pretty simply answered, but it just confirms that from earlier in the
book.
Right.
Like how it says, your father used it mainly for sneaking off to the kitchens to steal food. Why is stealing food from the kitchen such a big thing that, like, all the rebels of Hogwarts do when it's really,
okay,
it's so easy?
Okay, but I totally get it, because do they not have, like, access to snacks?
Yeah. Good question.
I mean, besides what they've purchase on their own, like, when they go to Hogsmeade.
This is,
like,
why obesity isn't a problem at Hogwarts. It's all about snacking, folks.
I would seriously die, like, especially as a kid, I used to need to eat constantly, not just when meals are served.
Right, an S-N-A-C-K. Our parents used to never say the word snack out loud before Alice could read because she would get too excited.
Yeah, because I love snacking, and I can remember moments when I would be, like, away at summer camp or I don't even know where else, and just being on a schedule where you're not allowed to eat snacks.
Dang it, or, when is snack time?
Well, where you don't have control over when you eat.
Yeah.
I can see why people stole food at Hogwarts.
Okay, I'm just saying, I can see why people stole food at Hogwarts too, but why
it's
was
almost
it
like
such
a Jean Valjean. Is that justifiable to me?
Right, but I'm saying it's not even a crime. The house elves just give it to you. Like, it's like only the real rebellious people at Hogwarts do it. And I'm not saying that it's ridiculous that people do it. I'm saying it's ridiculous that it's considered such a, like, cool thing to do. And really, it's basically, like, so easy. It's like taking candy from a baby, basically. Which, actually, taking candy from a baby, that's probably not that easy. Have people talked about this before? Babies want the candy.
Well, I was going to say, do babies even want candy? Like, how old is this baby? It's probably not even good for the baby, so it's actually kind of like a favor so the baby doesn't choke on, like, a piece of hard candy.
But here's the thing. Like, a baby's holding something at once. You take it from it, that baby's going to start screaming. I mean, you take
that's
something
true,
from a baby.
That's true, but you just saved the baby's life from choking to death.
Yeah, I'm not going to use that phrase anymore because it's dumb.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But one quick thing I was going to float, one theory. Maybe Dumbledore just said that to kind of discourage Harry from getting up to any serious trouble.
Yeah, and also one kind of darker thing. I wonder if Dumbledore, you know, he knows that this is part of the Deathly Hallows and he's given up on that quest. But I could kind of see maybe when Dumbledore did discover that James Potter had this, the third part of the Deathly Hallows, he might have kind of resented James for it a little bit. Kind of like, oh, you used this for going to the kitchens? Like, you could have used this for becoming the master of death.
I mean, I don't know. That seems a little far-fetched.
I don't think that's what he's saying here. I'm just saying that when Dumbledore discovered it, he was in a very dark place in his life. And I could see him kind of being like, this is ridiculous.
Sure, okay, if you say so. I don't know if I completely buy that take on it. I do see what you're saying a little bit, but...
Do you?
All right, so the last question that Harry asks is about Snape. Oh, wait, no. So the next question that Harry asks is about Snape. I like how always, this is a recurring thing that happens throughout the series, that Harry says, calls him Snape, and then Dumbledore will correct him and say, Professor Snape. Yeah. And this is where, like I said, Harry goes, Quirrell said that Snape hates me because he hated my father. Is that true? And then Dumbledore says, yes, they did detest each other. He doesn't try to lie about it. And he's like, not unlike you and Mr. Malfoy. So maybe you're right. Like, maybe the teachers, they just know what's going on enough at the school.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Because it's not like Dumbledore is really mixing it up with the students all that often.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, of course, Dumbledore knows that Snape hated James because that's part of his confession to Dumbledore when he turns to the good side or the light or whatever. He's saying that he was in love with Lily and he hated James, but he will protect Harry.
Yeah, that's true.
So of course Dumbledore knows.
Yeah, so it says he believes that he worked hard to protect Harry because he felt it would make him and your father even. So that's not exactly true.
No, Dumbledore's lying there.
Yeah, even though he said he wasn't going to lie.
Either he's lying or he doesn't know Snape's whole backstory, J.K. Rowling doesn't know Snape's whole backstory, but I'm gonna say I think J.K. Rowling knows Snape's backstory, so I think he's lying.
So, but Dumbledore said he explicitly said he wouldn't lie. I kind of think it's a half-truth.
It definitely has part of the truth. It's definitely, yeah, you're
right.
It's
just not the whole truth. He's not like, doesn't go into the whole thing. Yeah, Snape was super into your mom. And Snape was, you know, so he was trying to protect you because he owed that to her, even though she never cared for him. I mean, she never cared for him as more than a friend, and he was kind of a creeper. All right, and then finally, the final question was, Harry said, how did I get the stone out of the mirror? And this is when Dumbledore confirms that he had to want to find the stone but not use it, and that it would be difficult for most wizards to achieve because most of them would be too tempted by the gold or the elixir of life.
And it's funny, Dumbledore's being, like, really bragging about how he had this brilliant idea to how to protect the stone with the mirror. He says, "My brain surprises even me sometimes." That kind of sounds a little bit like you.
Excuse me.
A line that you might say, just sort of like, "Oh, my brain surprises even me sometimes."
Right, but I would be kidding.
A little bit. It'd be a half-truth.
Right. Well, that's the same as Dumbledore, I guess. I guess just Dumbledore and I were in the same league.
Oh, right. It's okay. I've compared myself to Hermione on this podcast before, so I'll take it. I mean, I'll let you do it.
I'm just kidding. I've never once thought I was actually similar to Dumbledore before.
Well, you do have some Grindelwald-like friends.
Uh-huh, right.
Shady people. No, I'm just kidding.
That's true. Okay, but anyway, then the scene kind of has some comic relief at the end when Dumbledore decides to try a Bertie Bott's every flavored beans and he gets an earwax flavored one. I've always kind of wondered how he knows that it's earwax flavored. Like, I don't know what earwax tastes like.
You haven't tasted earwax before?
Not really. I mean, not in a large enough quantity to really have an idea of what it tastes like.
I've definitely tasted earwax before.
Ew.
Probably during my aunt phase. I definitely was like, I wonder what earwax tastes like. And
probably because of this book.
No, I don't think so. I just stuck my finger in my ear, dug around.
Ew,
stuck it in
stop.
My mouth.
That's disgusting. The way you just described that was horrible.
I can't be the only one who's done that. I'm probably the only one who has eaten ants, but earwax, yeah, I mean,
I'd rather eat
kid,
an ant
curious.
Than.
It's like eating boogers.
Okay, well, anyway, let's move on.
A lot less gross than... Actually, no. The taste of earwax is a lot grosser than the taste of boogers.
Thank you, Martha. Let's move on to Ron and Hermione.
Earwax seriously is disgusting, so I'm just... Sorry. It's very bad. It tastes way worse than it smells.
I guess Dumbledore is old enough that he's probably tasted most things at this point.
I don't think when you're Dumbledore's age, you still aren't going to know what earwax tastes like.
Well, maybe I'll get curious later tonight.
Oh, right. Maybe that's what you're doing right now, huh?
Gross, no. Okay, like I said, moving on. Here we get Madame Pomfrey again being a little bit of a stickler for the rules. And Ron and Hermione are trying to come visit Harry, and she doesn't really want to let them.
Right, but then she breaks down, or not breaks down, they wear her down. She's able
she caves.
Yeah, so they come in, and it's a good scene. I like it a lot.
Yeah, Hermione, of course, wants to fling her arms around him, but Harry said he was glad because his head was very sore. Yeah. So he didn't want her to do that.
It's so, like... I mean, I can relate. I really don't like hugs very much, and I'd be grateful for the excuse of a headache to refuse a hug in that scene.
Mm-hmm. So they kind of, a lot of this time that they're visiting him is spent catching, with Harry catching them up on what's happened.
Right. I love the way that we find out, well, the way that Harry tells the story. It's just this kind of, it's that, indirect dialogue where it says what Harry tells them. We've already heard all of it, of course. So it says, when Ron and Hermione were a very good audience, they gasped in all the right places. And when Harry told them what was under Quirrell's turban, Hermione screamed out loud.
I would too. It's scary.
It's kind of like, I'm just imagining, like, and he took off the turban and it was Voldemort.
And it was a white face with red eyes and two slits for nostrils. And then they're picturing the snake nose immediately, like no nose.
Yeah. Like slits for a nose. And Harry's like, no, slits for nostrils. They're like, oh, too late.
Exactly. He's like, no, there was a nose. There just weren't very big nostrils.
Like, well, you should make that a little bit more clear, Harry.
And I like how it says it was one of the rare occasions when the true story is even more strange and exciting than the wild rumors.
Right.
Because, as we know, there's been wild rumors floating around the school.
Right. because of course it was the big secret, so naturally everyone knows.
And yeah, exactly. So then we get into the discussion about the Dumbledore conspiracy theories, because Hermione says she brought Ron upstairs, and just as they were dashing up to the owlery, they meet Dumbledore, and he says, "Harry's gone after him, hasn't he?" And so that shows you Dumbledore did know.
He knew.
He knew what Harry was doing.
You can definitely try to decide which tone Dumbledore said it in. It could be, "Harry's gone after him, hasn't he?" Or it could be, "Harry's gone after him, hasn't he? Like, haha, my plan has worked."
Or, "Harry's gone after him, hasn't he?"
Yeah, there's lots of different ways that it could have been said, and I'm kind of inclined to think that it's accompanied by the sly, I enjoyed this. Or, I didn't enjoy it. I intended this.
I anticipated this.
Yes. I caused this.
But here it's a little bit confusing because that Dumbledore said that he must have crossed paths with the owl, but here it says that Hermione and Ron didn't actually get to send an owl.
Right.
But so, not too important.
No. I think it's just kind of Dumbledore's just being really wordy, and he wanted to say, "We must have crossed midair."
So then here we get finally Ron putting it into words. He says, "Do you think he meant you to do it? Sending you your father's cloak and everything?" I feel like his father's cloak is like the smallest piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, like
Dumbledore, that's the thing that Ron listens to. Or,
and then I love Hermione's reaction. She says, "Well, if he did, I mean to say, that's terrible. You could have been killed."
Right, she explodes when she says that.
And then Harry, I mean, this speaks to the fact that he's going to be the chosen one in just a few books, and he's kind of okay with it, because he's like, "Well, you know what? I think he wanted to give me a chance, and it's fine. It's fine with me to be used as a piece of the puzzle."
Yeah.
And then I like how Ron says, "Yep, Dumbledore's off his rocker, all right."
Yeah.
Says it proudly.
Yeah, I think it says, earlier it says that Ron's looking quite impressed at how crazy his hero was.
Yeah, I agree. That was a funny line. So then Madame Pomfrey kicks them out, and then we get the next guest comes in, and that's Hagrid.
Yes. And
he's just sobbing. He's finally put it together in his head that it wasn't a good idea to tell that stranger how to get past Fluffy.
Right, that evil git.
And he says, "I'll never drink again." So I like how this kind of turns into a lesson about drinking for young readers.
I like how it says, "I should be chucked out and made to live as a muggle."
Yeah, Dumbledore probably should have done that years ago.
Seriously, that's what Malfoy thinks. Instead, he's made him into sort of a savage.
But, you know, Harry does not hold Hagrid responsible for any of it.
No, he's like,
he said he would have found it out anyway.
Yeah, he's like, "This is Voldemort we're talking about." Hagrid's like, "Don't say the name!" As he's sobbing. "You could have died!" And then Harry bellows, "Voldemort!"
And Hagrid's so shocked he stops crying.
Right. And Harry shows some real bravery here. He's really standing up to his friend, of course, which is true bravery, as we learned in just a few pages. But he's saying, "Hagrid, just get over it. Like, I saved the stone. I'm going to call him Voldemort. Have some candy."
And then Hagrid gives Harry this gift. And I like how he says that Dumbledore gave him the day off to fix it.
Right.
He needs a whole day to make this scrapbook.
Right. And he says, I got you a present. And Harry says, "It's not a stoat sandwich, is it?" No.
Went back to the weasel sandwiches.
"I didn't bring you any fresh weasel today."
So he gives him this leather-covered book filled with wizard photographs of his parents.
Right. It's interesting.
It's
interesting that it says that Hagrid sent owls off to all Harry's parents' old friends from school. I mean, who else besides Lupin is he writing to?
I was thinking about that earlier. Maybe other people from the Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah, it's possible.
But I guess old school friends, generally.
I mean, it's surprising that there'd be so many photos of them from school because they were only dating for their last year of school. I mean, Lily hated James up until seventh year, right? So, or sixth year, I guess.
Yeah, but maybe they had photos from their wedding and stuff.
Yeah, so I feel like Lupin, I think you're right. It's probably a few people from the Order as well.
Yeah.
But Hagrid probably didn't want to say a few of the few of their friends from the society that was created to like whatever. I mean, he doesn't want to give away the Order. He's smart enough to know that, I guess.
Right. You know, it's kind of weird that Hagrid didn't give this to him sooner. Like, okay, when could he have given it to him? Maybe for his 11th birthday when he picked him up and met him.
Yeah.
And was going to have to tell him the story.
Maybe for Christmas.
Maybe for Christmas when he decided that he would give him a flute. Finally, Hagrid's got the gift-giving down.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a nice gift, and it's probably one of the best gifts Harry ever gets.
I think so.
So. All right, and then we get into, finally, this last scene where they're at the feast, and it's all decorated for the Slytherins. And we love it in the movie, of course.
Yes.
Yes, yes, well done, Slytherin, well done, Slytherin, however.
Yeah, it's so perfect. That's, the best thing that Richard Harris does in the series.
You see the Slytherins smirking, you see the smiles sliding off their face.
Right. It's, well, and right before that in the book, it says Harry could see Draco Malfoy banging his goblet on the table. It was a sickening sight.
Great line.
Yes.
There you see a little bit of some of the Dudley in Malfoy.
Yeah, totally. Like banging his goblet on the table. So savage.
But so then Dumbledore says he has a few last-minute points to award, and we've got the points divvied up. Ron gets 50 points for the best-played game of chess Hogwarts has seen in many years. To me, this always stood out. Like, I mean, it was a great game of chess, but Quirrell just played across the board as well.
Yeah, but I think it has to do with the fact that Ron sacrificed himself.
Yeah, probably.
That he knew that he was able to do that.
That's true. Hermione, for the use of cool logic in the face of fire. That's kind of punny of Dumbledore there.
Yeah, yeah. Go back to the Ron thing just for a second. I love how it says, Ron went purple in the face. He looked like a radish with a bad sunburn.
Yeah, typical Ron.
Right, and Percy's like shouting. He's like, my brother! My youngest
brother!
Yeah, he's
like bragging about his brother.
Right. But yeah, Hermione gets the points and she buries her face in her arms. Harry's like pretty sure she's crying, which I would be.
Then he gives 60 points to Harry for pure nerve and outstanding courage.
Yeah.
And then they're all kind of adding up the points in their head and realizing that they're exactly tied with Slytherin.
Right. It says, if only Dumbledore had given Harry just one more point. And of course, it's like, it's so, makes so much sense that everybody's like, oh, it must be done. Like, who else? Like, Neville's totally forgotten. Of course, Neville's part in the story is extremely minor. But it is an important part, of which we're going to see soon. But, you know, Harry himself is kind of just like, well, that's it. If only I'd gotten one more point. But then, of course, Dumbledore comes in and says that there are all kinds of courage. But
Okay, and so in my memory, I always remember this as it takes even more to stand up to our friends. Is that what it says in the movie?
It's possible. Because
in the book here, it says, it takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends. So equal.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I had it in my head that it took more, and I honestly think it takes more.
I think so too.
But anyway, he awards Neville 10 points, and I love that he does that last because he could have easily done that one first, and then Harry would have gotten the glory at the end.
Right.
But Harry gets enough glory, and Dumbledore knows that, so yes. He does it to Neville
exactly.
Now. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. And of course, like, Neville disappears under a pile of people hugging him and says he had never won so much as a point for Gryffindor before. And so it's just awesome.
Yeah, it's really sweet. And we see Malfoy who couldn't have looked more stunned and horrified if he'd just had the body bind curse put on him.
Yeah, I kind of picture him like holding a shattered glass. Like the goblet he was just banging on the table is broken.
I mean, it's also kind of, okay, going back to the sweet moment where Dumbledore awards Neville the points, It's like it was strategic into helping Neville to feel really great.
Yeah.
It was also strategic in helping the Slytherins to feel really horrible.
Totally.
Because they wouldn't have been tied, you know?
Right.
It would have been that Harry would have overtaken them with the 60 points easily.
Right. But there's that dramatic silence between, I mean, you think that it's over.
Dumbledore just wants to drag it out to, like, rub it in the Slytherin's face.
Totally. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and then he's like, well, down with the Slytherin's decorations. Yeah. He snaps his fingers and they're all replaced.
It claps his
that
hands.
That was so harsh.
Yes, it really is. But of course, like, all the teachers are cheering and stuff, too, because this is it was going to be Slytherin's seventh year winning the House Cup.
Yeah, well, you know what? Then they need to be taken down a few pegs.
Right.
So then Harry sees Snape through the crowd, and he realizes that Snape still hates him.
Yeah.
But it's almost like a calming moment for Harry, because he's like, well, life's back to normal here.
Yeah, exactly. I like that, too. It's part of Hogwarts that Snape's going to hate Harry. So he's kind of almost relieved that part of his life is still normal.
I will say that J.K. Rowling does a great job with, like we said, these serious moments, but she also does a great job with the really happy moments.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The lines, I mean, they're just as powerful, almost. I mean, he says, it was the best evening of Harry's life, better than winning at Quidditch or Christmas or knocking out mountain trolls. He would never, ever forget tonight.
Yeah, that's really, really awesome. I love the way she writes that because after, you know, it says been Harry's best Christmas ever, and he says, like, it's the best feeling ever when he wins Quidditch and knocking out mountain trolls, he gets a new best friend, but this is the night that he's always going to remember. This is the night that's the best of his life, and it really solidifies the fact that Harry's life is totally changed from that life that he's lived for the last 10 years, this horrible, miserable life at the Dursleys, and this is his life now at Hogwarts, and he just is having an amazing time.
And it's great because it gives us a little bit of a recap of what happened in the book.
So
you can think back, like, all the great moments that Harry's had, what an adventure he's been on just in one year.
Totally.
So it's great. And then we have the falling action.
Yeah.
Or the conclusion, I guess. That was kind of the falling action. And we're into the conclusion now. Everything is getting packed up. And they get their exam results. Hermione gets the best of all the first years, and even Neville passes.
Yeah.
And even back here, it says he had his good herbology mark making up for his abysmal potions one.
Right.
So he was good at herbology from the very beginning.
Yeah.
It shows all the students walking out to leave Hogwarts, and, you know, they're doing all these magical things. They're eating Bertie Bott's every flavored beans on the train, and pulling off their wizard robes and putting on jackets and coats, and it's just, you know, a reversal of what we saw earlier in the book.
Yeah.
And then they get off the platform and they go to the gateway toward the Muggle world. And this is kind of interesting because I always feel like it's kind of weird because the Weasleys meet Ron on the other side.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Why don't they meet him on platform 9 3/4?
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, they pull into platform 9 3/4, and I guess they're on the other side of platform 9 3/4 at King's Cross. I don't know.
Yeah. They're already... Maybe it says they pass through the gateway, and then they hear Ginny saying, there he is!
Oh, it's just, I think it's just because it'd be too crowded if all the families were on the other side of the wall, you know, at the Hogwarts Express platform. They need to be... Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. It just seems like it makes sense, I guess.
Right. So anyway, and I think it's also a moment for the Weasleys to meet Uncle Vernon.
Which I love.
Uncle Vernon's there, and he says... it says he looked furious at the nerve of Harry to carry an owl in a cage in a station full of ordinary people.
Right. Mrs. Weasley says, "You must be Harry's family." And Uncle Vernon says, in a manner of speaking.
And Ron has invited Harry to come spend some time at his house.
Right, in a really weird way. He says, "You must come and stay this summer," which is so
sounds like something
proper.
His own mother would say.
Yeah, like, "You must come and stay this summer."
Also, like, maybe you could have mentioned this a little bit earlier so we could have started some planning.
Yeah, seriously.
But Hermione, it was very taken aback at Uncle Vernon. She's shocked that anyone could be so unpleasant.
Yeah.
And then she says, "Hope you have a good holiday." And then Harry closes out. He says, "Oh, I will." And he's grinning. And it says, "They don't know we're not allowed to use magic at home. I'm going to have a lot of fun with Dudley this summer.
It's a great ending.
It is. I will say, I love the ending. It shows again, like you said earlier, how much Harry's situation has changed.
Yeah.
And he really knows, you know, what he can do. I will say, though, that it always confused me because I always thought he was going to thought that he could use the magic on Dudley and just get away with it. But it just he just means it as a threat to hang over Dudley's head.
Yeah. Another time that you read something differently than me because I always knew what it meant.
Well, anyway, I did read this when I was like 11.
So did I.
Or no, I was 9.
I was 9. I was in fourth grade.
But anyway, it's a great ending to a great book, and we are officially all wrapped up.
That is crazy. We're not officially yet because we need to do the real weirdo and the ranking.
And we have to assign our Harry moment.
Yeah. So can't we just give him the real weirdo for this chapter?
I don't know who else to give it to. That's the thing.
I mean,
Dumbledore's already gotten it twice.
Or the Neville argument, but Neville doesn't do anything in the chapter. He just gets the points. Yeah. And he's already gotten it once. I mean, I just feel like it should be Harry. But we said earlier that he was going to get an award for something, but it wouldn't be the actual real weirdo of the chapter. Can we retract that statement?
Well, we could give it to Voldemort because he knew the exact right moment to detach the soul from the body.
We could give it to Quirrell. I mean, that's the one thing I was thinking, but...
We have given it to evil people in the past, haven't we?
Yes. Well...
But he died, and he was kind of dumb.
Yeah, he was dumb. We could give it to Voldemort. It's the first time we see Voldemort in the series. Besides the Forbidden Forest, I guess.
He had a relatively strong...
I think we
first
should give
appearance.
It to, let's give it to Voldemort.
Okay.
Let's decide
okay.
on a place to give Harry the real weirdo.
Or okay. Because personally, I would kind of like to give Harry the real weirdo for that moment we talked about way earlier where he gives Neville a chocolate frog.
I know. I was just thinking that too.
That's my favorite moment of him because he's just, even though, I think it just shows his character.
I think so too. I really like that scene, too. Let's do that. I like that a lot better, actually.
Okay.
The only other time I was thinking, we could give it to Harry for when he smiles encouragingly at Quirrell.
That's our other favorite moment.
But yeah, I do think I'd rather reward Harry for his kindness and selflessness than for his bravery, because his bravery obviously is amazing, but his kindness and... selflessness is something that's overlooked more. So yeah, I think that scene with Neville is a great one to give Harry the award for.
Okay. So we've given that was in the chapter called Nicholas Flamel, right?
Yes.
Because it was right before he found out.
Yes.
Who Nicholas Flamel was.
Right.
All right. Well, that's when we awarded Harry the award for the best Harry moment of the book. And the real weirdo for this chapter is going to be Voldemort. Now, as a reminder, that doesn't mean the hero of the chapter necessarily. It just means the person who had their breakout episode, basically.
Right. And this totally is Voldemort's coming out party.
Yeah. All right. And now, finally, we have to rank our chapter. Martha, where are you thinking about putting our chapter?
You know, it's a good chapter. It's not a top three chapter for me the way that Through the Trapdoor was. I think... It's top half, maybe somewhere around 5, 6, 7, somewhere in there for me. I think it's really good. It's got some great moments of truth where, you know, we're talking about the truth of the night that James and Lily died and those things. But at the same time, like you said, there's a lot of falling action and it's not... There's only one real character, you know, who's driving the action in the chapter. And I think a lot of the great moments in these other chapters are when there's lots of characters and lots of dynamics between characters. So I think somewhere top, I mean, the bottom of the top half. So where...
Personally, I think that's a little too low for it. I think it should go in slot 4. So it would be Mirror of Erised, Through the Trapdoor, and then The Boy Who Lived, and then... The Man with Two Faces.
Okay.
The reason I think that, like you said, it was a decent amount of falling action, but, you know, there were really powerful lines from Dumbledore.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And there was really, a wonderful moment when he got the points award it to his house.
Okay, you're right. Let's do that. I like that spot for it. Because, those top three, I want to stay where they are.
I think it's definitely better than Diagon Alley.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at now. I'm thinking, Diagon Alley, Journey from Platform 9 and 3 Quarters. Those are great, but they're a lot lighter than this one. And yeah. I think we should give this one chapter slot 4. That's a good spot for it.
Right.
So that's going to be our final ranking for this book. Once we're finished, which we are, when we're finished with a book, we're going to stop the ranking and start over when we start the new book. So when we read the first chapter of The Chamber of Secrets, it's not going to be ranked in relation to these 17 chapters of Sorcerer's Stone.
We'll start fresh.
Right. So you can find that final list on our website, realweirdsisters.com, and you can find the list of the real weirdos too. And we'll also put the mention of Harry's, what are we going to call that? Harry's honorable mention or Harry's breakout moment?
We'll have to think of a name for it. So if anybody has any suggestions, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah. Especially Courtney's the one who suggested this in the first place. So if she has any ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd love to hear them because that was a great idea. I'm really glad we're doing that now.
Yeah, me too.
Just some housekeeping. Now that we're finished with the first book, we're going to be moving on to Chamber of Secrets. And in between that, though, we are going to release a couple of special topics episodes. We are still hoping, though, to put out a Harry Potter and the Cursed Child episode the day after it comes out. So that'd be August 1st, which is also the day that this episode is scheduled to come out. So it would be later in the day, probably like sometime in the afternoon or evening. So keep an eye out for that. Barring any technical difficulties, that should be out on Monday, August 1st.
Right.
Really excited to read Cursed Child and to talk about that with you. And I can't wait.
Me too.
It's going to be awesome. And then, so there's a couple other things, though. So it's going to be a lot of content coming out this week. So we've got that. Then we've also got our appearance on Trivial Warfare, which should be coming out really soon as well, if it's not out already by the time that this episode gets released. That, again, Martha and I were on this trivia show. We competed against two other teams in Harry Potter trivia, mostly about the books. And it was really fun. Mm-hmm. Won't give away any results, but we will post that on our Facebook, so make sure that you follow us on there, facebook.com/realweirdsisters, or also on our Twitter @realweirdsister. We'll be sharing that link there so you can go ahead and listen to that episode. It'll be really fun. The questions were great. I think they'll be really fun for people to play along at
home.
Totally.
Yeah. And then the third special topics episode that we'll be releasing is our movie cast. We're going to have two special guests on this episode, and we're going to discuss the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone movie. Basically, going to go over the differences between it and the book now that we're finished with the book, and we're going to talk about things we liked, things we didn't like, people we liked, people we didn't like, everything about the movie, basically. So, yeah, and that episode is going to get released on our regular Monday release day. Instead of releasing a book club episode on that day, we're actually going to have that movie cast. So that's going to be a little bit different from usual. But after Monday, August 8th, you can expect our regular book club episodes coming. And hopefully you'll be able to enjoy our movie episode, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about the movie of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, that stuff's not going to, expire. You can listen to that whenever. Just make sure that you are subscribed to us in iTunes so that you don't miss any of those, because they will be coming out on days other than Monday.
Right.
Otherwise, though, we will, like I said, we will be back with Chapter 1 of Chamber of Secrets. I'm really excited to get into a new book, Martha. Are you?
I am, too. Chamber of Secrets, I will say, is historically my least favorite book of the series, and I think that's a pretty common opinion for fans.
Yeah,
but
it's mine, too.
At the same time, I'm very excited to reread it, just because, I mean, I've been honestly getting a little fatigued by Sorcerer's Stone. Maybe it's just going so slow because we're going one week at a time, of course. But it's going to be fun to have a new adventure to be talking about.
Yeah, me too. And for me, Chamber of Secrets is also my least favorite, but I remember that fact led me to reread it a lot less.
Uh-huh.
So the times I have reread it, I've been pleasantly surprised, because there's been a lot of scenes in it that I don't necessarily remember, whereas Sorcerer's Stone, I mean, there's not a whole lot that I see in there that I don't remember.
True. And I'll also say Chamber of Secrets is one of my very favorites of the movies. I think it's one of the ones that follows the book the very best, I would say. And so that's another reason that I'm looking forward to it. I'm eager to see if my opinion changes too.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone again for listening. If you do get a chance to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it. We really appreciate everyone's support And until next week, we're the Real Weird Sisters.
We're the Weird Sisters, we're the Real Weird Sisters. All you other Weird Sisters are fine, but not the Vickers. Will the Real Weird Sisters please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up. Please stand up.